Welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Tom Tykwer and his 2006 film Perfume. Returning on the show today to talk about Perfume is Professor Marie Wester. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So yeah, this is a very bizarre movie, and I don't think it's for everyone. And for the most part, I would say I was able to go along with it. I was like, okay, I kind of like this. And then it gets to like that last 20 minutes where even for as bizarre as the movie was, it just kind of got from like, okay, now this is just stupid. This is just ridiculous. And so like the last 20 minutes and the scene, you know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. That scene, I'm just like, okay, now this is just getting ridiculous. And it just really lost me at that those last 20 minutes.
I saw an interview with Tykwer where he said that he was trying to make a comment about celebrity, how we create these larger-than-life people, and then we devour them. I mean, literally, you've heard stories of rock stars who say they were pursued by their fans, and if they managed to beat the top of the car in, they just grab at them, hair, whatever they could just possess. So I think in that respect, what he's done is really very artistic and kind of daring.
And it is very daring. This is, like I said, I can see, looking at some of the reviews for it and the general consensus, it does seem to be very split. Like, either you really liked it or you really hated it. You think it's pretentious crap.
And pretentious crap.
Yeah, and I think I can definitely see why people would see that. I'm on the lines of, I think it's all right. I just, like I said, the last 20 minutes is kind of really derailed for me, but I still think it's a good movie. But I can see how it's just one of those movies, like, you know, Mother, that came out this year, where it's just like you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. It's definitely one of those movies.
You definitely have to be looking for something a little different. And you're right, it's definitely not for everyone. I don't even know if it's really suited for an American audience, even though it has big names in it. Oh, I always like to tell people it's the best Dustin Hoffman movie you've never seen. It's the best
Alan Rickman
movie you've never seen.
And Q from James Bond.
Yes, it's actually got quite a few people in it.
Yeah, it's got a lot of people. It's directed by the guy who did Run Lola Run, which anybody who takes any film class, I'm pretty sure, has seen that movie. So it's got like a lot of people you know doing, you know, but it does seem it's something that's really been lost. But it's one of those movies that I'm not sure if you show this to a mainstream audience what their reaction is going to be, especially during that scene at the end.
Well, you know, it is based on a very weird book by the same name, and everybody was interested in making it into a movie. Ridley Scott wanted to do it. Tim Burton wanted to do it.
Yeah, I could
Martin
see Burton
Scorsese
doing it.
Wanted to do it. Just think what Martin Scorsese would have done with it, with the violence. Milos Forman, Stanley Kubrick, Roman Polanski, Claude Berry, Julian Schnabel. I mean, all of these people were desperate to make this movie because they just thought the topic was so interesting. The book's so compelling. It makes the Jean-Baptiste character even darker. He's meant to be sort of grotesque, almost like Quasimodo.
Yeah, I could definitely see Tim Burton doing this because, in a way, the way he kind of highlights the disgust and the filth of, you know, 18th century Europe is very similar to what we saw in Sweeney Todd, the movie.
Well, you know, the fish market scenes were shot in Barcelona's Gothic Quarter. 2.5 tons of fish and 1 ton of meat was used over the course of the shoot, and people as far away as 6 miles reported a bad smell in the air.
Yeah, it's a really, like, that, especially that beginning scene when he's born, it's filthy looking.
It's disgusting.
Like, I can imagine somebody that's, like, watching that, because this is one of the first scenes of the movie, and they're just like, okay, that's it for me, because, I mean, you're seeing this baby being born, and the mom just...
Squalor.
Yeah, and mom just doesn't even, she's like, oh, another one, just cuts the umbilical cord, just lets him, like, lie in the dirt, and then there's all these, dead fish lying on the ground and vegetables and other filth, and it's just like, you can just almost feel, like you talked about how you can almost smell the filth.
You can. Yeah, that's how the movie was actually sold to me several years ago. The VPAA here was a man named Ron Roberson, an artist and a gentleman, and he was a big time film fan, but he liked not, you know, your slice of life thing. He wanted to see, you know, show me something different. Mm-hmm. And so he told me about this film and he said, you know, it doesn't sound possible, but you'll swear you could smell some of the things just because of the vividness in which Tykwer photographs everything. Yeah. You feel like you can really smell it. And not everything smells good.
No, definitely not. And it's, you know, like you talked, it's one of those movies that really, it's like highlights senses. Like you can, like the smell, just like you, even though you can't smell, you can just feel like you can smell everything, whether it's the perfume, whether it's the, you know, like I said, the squalor and the filth, you know, kind of like when you watch Chef, how you can just like taste everything that's being cooked. It's one of those great like sense movies.
One of the critics I read said that the movie was trying to ask the question, what would feelings look like? What would they smell like? And I think the movie does a good job of that because nobody tries to work with your sense of smell in a movie. I mean, you really can't unless you have the smell-o-vision thing. And even then, that's not very convincing. But Tickfer is interesting because he's always trying to bring in a different sensory addition to his movies. You know, like Lola with her sense
Lola.
Of touch. And,
yeah.
And he's done short stuff where he'll deliberately use a character who's blind mm-hmm. or who has some other missing one sense, but then super sensory in another respect. So that's something I think he likes to play around with. But nobody's ever, I think, successfully given you a sense of smell without giving you anything to smell.
And it's funny you were talking about Run, Lola, Run. I kept in this movie how, you know, once you kind of exit this person's life, he never sees them again. You see what happens to him after. I kept thinking of a Run, Lola, Run. So it's like we're kind of getting the picture, the quick little picture shots of like what happened to them after.
Now, you know, given that the opening shows that Jean-Baptiste's mother did not want him, do you think she was actually doing the world a favor given, you know, the monster he turned into?
She would have done the right thing. It sounds terrible, but it would have been the overall, she would have saved a lot of people's lives.
So there is that sort of question. It starts off so filthy and so undesirable, but at the end of the movie, you almost wonder, well, maybe that's how it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. And I got to ask, so have you read the book?
I do. I have read the book, but it's been a long time. The book is, of course, you know, goes into more details, it's a lot more descriptive.
Oh, okay.
The movie is sort of lush, and even the squalor is depicted really well.
It's a very incredibly well-shot film. I don't know who the cinematographer is, but the cinematography I wrote is extremely lush, like especially when they show the beauty of like the houses and they show the grape fields, and it looks like a painting, looks like an old 18th century painting. And it's really great. It's a really well-shot movie. Even when you show the filth and the squalor, that still looks good.
And the shops and things on the bridges. Mm-hmm. Crossing the Seine. Those were cool.
Yeah.
All those scenes in the perfumery with Dustin Hoffman, I mean, those were really interesting and kind of that, you know, and now you're apprenticing to the Rumpelstiltskin until you can find the, you know, your way out. It's interesting to me also that there's something almost Aesop's Fables about the story. He's sort of magical in a way, but in an evil way. But I don't think he, and his heart is evil.
He doesn't really think what he's doing is bad. He just wants to capture the perfect scent.
Yes, yeah. Yes. He's driven in this way. Yeah, which is very unusual. I mean, they do say that people who work with wine and perfume have to have a super sensory gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess you can't cultivate it. You either have it or you don't.
Yeah, I guess I can see that making sense.
But every time he leaves one of his masters, the Jean-Baptiste character, he dies.
Yeah, they die. And that's the ones again. It's kind of like one roll to run. Like, oh, here's what's happened to them after he comes in contact with them. And we talk about just the movie. Like, one of the things that always cracks me up is when you see, look at the rating, it says R, and it says, for an aberrant scene. and like, I remember this is very similar to The Neon Demon, which I watched last year, and there's rated R, and it says for an aberrant sexuality scene. And I, at that time, I was like, "What does aberrant mean?" And so when I watched Neon Demon, I was like, "Oh, that's what that means."
That's what that means.
Yeah. And in this movie, I was like, "Uh-oh, there's going to be something weird like that in like Neon Demon." And like,
yes.
"Oh, yeah, okay."
Yes, big time. I guess the other thing I think is sort of sickly genius about the movie is that this whole idea that there are women or some women who possess, you know, this magical essence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think in some ways that is sort of an assumption that there is something about extremely beautiful women that if you could just capture what that is, and it's not really about, you know, having the perfect facial features or whatever. There's an ineffable quality. I think it tries to get to the heart of how can you capture that? And if you did, how would it be done? And it kind of seems like he's probably onto something. Not that nobody get any ideas. This is
not
education for serial killers. But, you know, he is sort of animalistic. He sort of stalks his prey. without any sort of evil intent. I guess there's no real way to say it.
Yeah, I guess in his way, he doesn't think it's evil. He's, for the most part, it's not like he's cutting them up or anything. He just suffocates them. Now, he still, in the end, he still doesn't really feel any remorse for what he's doing, but it doesn't seem like he's doing it for, like, pleasure or anything. He's just trying, like, I want to capture this perfect scent, and only beautiful women can do it. It's almost a bit like some kind of creepy fairy tale.
Well, if you think about it as a commentary on celebrity, though, you could tell, you could say this guy comes from extremely humble beginnings. He has a particular talent that sets him apart, and he ruthlessly pursues being the best at that. So that all of his masters die in his wake, that all the beautiful women that he encounters, he just destroys as he makes his way towards the ultimate goal, which is that he has distilled the thing that everyone wants, and he now has it in a bottle. And then what he does is, you know, he's finally clambered to the top. Mm-hmm. He releases it so that everyone will love him. It does say something sort of metaphorical.
I do have to ask you about the end. I mean, we've been talking about how wild it felt that the film derailed. How did you feel about that whole scene once, okay, spoiler alert, once he gets the perfume, puts a little bit on himself before he's to be hanged. Then all of a sudden everybody's just overwhelmed that this man is innocent. And then they start tearing their clothes off and have this giant orgy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you think that was just like kind of, what the hell?
See, to me, I think, what else would you do with the elixir?
See, the way I thought it more was just he was trying, because he talks about how he has no scent. Like, he doesn't even have, like, BO. So it's almost like, you know, I always thought, like, by him having this, getting this scent from all these women so he can smell, it's more of he has an identity. Or that he's able to, so people will recognize him. I didn't all of a sudden he's going to get to the part where he's going to be able to get away with what he did, and then everybody's going to just, I don't know, it's like an aphrodisiac or something where everybody just becomes extremely horny and having the giant orgy. I didn't quite get that part. I thought it was just more him trying to just have an identity more than just, I want to be loved and adored by everyone.
You know, I thought it was more like the Sufi tradition of fana, where when you become very dedicated to a deity or a cause or whatever, you actually give yourself over to it until it annihilates you. So I think, you know, he was an odorless person. So he puts on this distilled scent that he has, you know, extracted from the best quality scent he could find. Now he finally smells like that. But what happens is that he is destroyed by it. But I think he knows that will happen because that's what happened to the original people who owned it. One of the messages is when you have the elixir, or you have the thing that everybody wants, they will kill you to get it.
That
but
makes sense.
It may manifest itself in an orgy first, so watch out. I thought the orgy scene was amazing in that there's how many people in the scene, but you don't ever really see anything.
Yeah, for the most part, no.
It's more of it's implied.
Yeah, and it's not even like you actually see them, you know, having sex. It's more like they're almost just like constantly touching each other. And touching and touching and touching. You don't see like actual like thrusting or something.
Well, but you don't even really see many body parts.
Yeah.
Now, Tickfer considered the orgy scene to be a dance, which needed choreographing. So he had a dance troupe help him put the scene together.
I would love to have been an extra in that scene. Just
well,
like,
you know, there were a lot of people involved in this. This is the most expensive German movie ever made, which isn't surprising.
Wow.
Yeah, they spent 15 weeks researching costumes. 1,400 costumes were made, and after they were shipped, they then had to be aged and dirtied, and once they were ready to be worn, Tickfer insisted that everybody wear them continuously and sleep in them, because that's what people did.
Mm.
So that's just an amazing amount of just the costumes. Then also, the book was the source of inspiration for the Nirvana song Scentless Apprentice. Kurt Cobain claimed to carry the book in his pocket and said he identified with John Baptiste's alienation. You know, he might have known something about that.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess
fame.
So.
Also,
yeah, exactly.
when they were,
well, especially what happened to him at the end.
Exactly, when they were filming the scenes in Paris, Tickfer was so meticulous that the crew gave him the nickname Lord of the Dirt.
You know, we've been talking a lot about this film. One thing I also and its influences. Another thing this film felt like a lot to me was a bit of like a Hitchcock movie, especially with its use of voyeurism, the way he keeps stalking all these women. and, you know, just like all the psychosexual undertones that feel, you know, he's very Norman Bates-ish, especially the way he's around women, where he doesn't have sex with any of them, but he still wants to, like, almost become them.
He wants to possess them,
yeah.
Yeah, this is even too sick for Hitchcock.
No.
You know, Hitchcock would have made it much more
classy, I guess.
Classy, yeah. He would have classed up the serial killer.
Yeah, and I guess I would talk a little bit about the actors. Ben Whishaw, who I mentioned earlier, he's a Q in the last two James Bond movies.
But more importantly, he's the voice of Paddington.
He's great as Paddington.
Like, he is.
The voice I think they talked about how, I forget, like some other very well-known actor to voice Paddington. And they didn't do it. I couldn't imagine anybody else voicing him. And even you're talking about how celebrity and everything. Whishaw talked about an interesting quote about how he kind of, you know, he was talking about celebrity status and everything. He's like, I don't know why, just because I'm an actor, people obsess over, you know, my personal life or everything I say, you know, and what I do every day. And he finds that creepy. So kind of, you know, once again, helps. He kind of almost brings that connection to that character.
Now, the one thing that doesn't match, but I think it works in the movie anyway, is that you don't have any sort of idea in the book that the character is attractive, and Ben Whishaw is an attractive man. Mm-hmm. But I think that sort of works because it makes him more, you know, like you don't suspect him because he just looks so benign.
Yeah, and that's just like in the movie, like he doesn't have a scent, like he has no identity. Nobody really thinks anything of him because he's a very skinny looking guy. He's very homely looking. He doesn't look like he could be a threat. That's why nobody ever really suspects him that he's doing all these terrible things.
And, you know, there is something to be said for the sympathy you have for him because of the hard way he comes up, because there were lots of opportunities for people to show him kindness, which would maybe have made a difference in the way he looked at the world. And even when he demonstrates this unique talent, the people around him want to take advantage of that too.
Yeah, and even when he's sentenced to the execution, everybody's just out for blood. They want to see him, you know, suffer the ultimate fate.
Now, I did think the stuff about making the perfume was kind of interesting, too. I mean, I did want to smell all of the things they were making to see what they smelled like. There is a place in France called Grasse where they actually do that.
Oh, right.
And they do go there in the film. So they made sure to, you know, mention the fact that this is where they, I think it was lavender or something, that they had, like, just an astonishing amount of flowers to make just a tiny little bit of perfume, but it's a big industry there.
Oh, I can imagine. And so Grasse is actually really a huge...
It's a real place.
That's interesting. Once again, it really kind of, it goes back to that, you know, the cinematography and I think even the set design and everything. The film
gorgeous.
Is really great. I mean, just the way when he's going through the mountains, like I said, the grape fields, once it looks like a painting, and even when we go in and out of the walls and they hide in that hotel, just everything is really incredibly shot in this film.
And see, I think that's also sort of an interesting metaphor in that, you know, you actually go to the part of the world where they cultivate things to turn into flowers. But even with all that beauty, none of that is what he's pursuing. It's still in that world, the most beautiful thing there is a woman.
Yeah, it's always him going back to that first woman, you know, which once again, that scene really defines the word aberrant. But it goes back and it's almost like he almost feels bad that he actually did that. And so almost feels like if he can get this scent and keep it, that it's almost a way like he can make up for what he did almost.
Well, yeah. Or at least release a scent to hypnotize people into loving him before they destroy him. I'm not sure what his goal is. I mean, what would you say?
Yeah,
I mean, other than actually creating the perfume and finally having done that, I mean, had he not been apprehended, what do you think he would have done after that?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's one of the things I had with this movie. I wasn't really sure what he was trying to do because I thought what I got from it, especially most of it, that's why I didn't really quite see the whole celebrity like he wanted to be adored. It was more just because it talks about how he has no scent and that he can't keep the scent. I thought it was... If he can have this scent on his body, whether it's like he smells great or he just has like really bad BO, he just has something where somebody can smell him. It's like so people will recognize him. Like he's always been
invisible,
ignored. And so having the scent, he'll be recognized.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I do think it's that quest for love. Because when you're dumped in the fish because your mother doesn't want you, and then you spend your whole life being used and abused by employers, you never find love from anybody. Yeah, what you're striving for probably is that you know, if I could just capture this thing that everybody else has and I have the perfect essence of it, then I would finally be loved. And then I don't care what happens. Tear me asunder because I will have finally gotten what I always wanted.
But at the end, we see that there's the tiniest little drop left. So do you think somebody's going to pick up on that? Do you think that's somebody's still going to try to make that scent?
I thought it was more like a, and this is the last drop.
Oh, okay. The last drop is done.
And I thought that was a powerful ending, too.
Okay. And we talked a little bit more about the other performances. Like you said, like this has got a big name cast. Like we're talking about Ben Whishaw. Dustin Hoffman's in it. I think he's pretty good. And you also have Alan Rickman, which also connects a little bit when I talked earlier about the Sweeney Todd. He kind of does a very kind of similar to his character in Sweeney Todd, where he's very protective of this young woman. In that movie, it's his wife. In this movie, it's his daughter.
Yeah. It's good to see those two classic actors. I think the movie would have had even more trouble making a dent in the American audience. But, you know, the Europeans loved it.
Yeah. So how overall did it do, like I say, monetary wise?
It didn't do well. But it's hard to, first of all, selling a movie about a serial killer. That's a hard sell, especially if you're going to go weird.
Yeah.
And especially if at the end, he's caught and he dies, but it's such a strange little trip through the orgy to get there.
Yeah.
There's so much about it that's just not a standard story.
Yeah, this is definitely not for a mainstream audience. Like when I talked earlier about the Neon Demon, like that's another film where I can just, like, there were people, I think, who watched it, and they were like, oh, my God, and just because there's scenes, and you're just like in this movie, like, what?
Now, I have used this in class in the past. I was able to stream this, but I
really
no longer have the
rights. Really curious
to
hear your students' reactions.
Well, I would show Run, Lola, Run in class, and I would say, so now you're going to go home and watch another Tom Tykwer movie, but I've got to be honest, you know, it's really weird. But I really liked the opportunity to show them something they've never seen before. I mean, you have to admit, you've never seen this movie before. And it's takes Run, Lola, Run in terms of colors and sensation to, like, the next level. But I don't think it's a movie that people go back to and say, you know, I think I'm going to put that movie on again over and over and over. It's something that you watch. You'll think about it for a long time.
Okay. We talked a lot. So we could go into a little bit now about Tom Tykwer. We talked about already a bit when we did our Run, Lola, Run show a while ago. Lately, I know he did that hologram for the King movie with Tom Hanks in it that I don't think anybody's ever seen.
I saw it.
And he did. He's also worked a lot with the Wachowskis. He did Cloud Atlas.
That was awful.
It's really awful.
No one saw it, and for good reason. The book was also incomprehensible. But that's one of those movies. How could it possibly fail with Tom Hanks and Halle Berry and all of the people that were in it? But it's just a mess. There was nothing that could save that movie.
So outside of Run, Lola, Run in this movie, what other Tykwer films would you recommend?
The International. It's a serviceable intrigue story involving the financial industry. It's got Clive Owen in it and Naomi Watts and Ulrich Thompson. So that's a pretty good movie. He also made a movie called Heaven, which was a German movie. Run, Lola, Run is definitely the place to start.
The biggest one, yeah. So, like I said, it's probably the one film anybody who takes a film class, especially like foreign film or independent film, you're probably going to see that movie.
Well, if you are a Tom Hanks fan, you can skip Cloud Atlas, you know, because you'll only fall asleep during it. But definitely check out Hologram for a King. I thought it was pretty good.
So what's the story? I mean, is he getting a hologram for the king?
He is in Saudi Arabia trying to sell a hotel. Saudi prince, or maybe it's the king, I can't remember, but the technology is such that they want to be able to have the super high-tech presentation with holograms. But of course, they're in the middle of the desert, the Wi-Fi's sort of iffy, you know, he's, you know, trying to find a nice cold beer in the middle of the desert where they don't have, you know, there's no liquor. He meets a wonderful woman who is, you know, very modern. So lots of things going on in his life.
And so since we're on the topic, this movie of very bizarre, aberrant films, I will say one film that probably makes this movie look like a summer blockbuster cookie cutter movie is Possession. Have you seen that movie?
You know, I haven't seen that movie. You know, that sounds like a horror movie. I haven't seen it.
It's Sam Neill from Jurassic Park and quite a few other things. And Isabella Janney. And it's almost a film I can't even describe.
Oh, wait a minute. Isabella Gianni. I might have seen it.
Okay, so it's the subway scene where she's completely freaking out and just screaming, and she's throwing stuff all around, and then like she's on the ground, there's blood coming out of her, and there's like this ooze.
Okay, this is not really about. Okay. But I do like Isabella Gianni, so I will watch it just to see.
It's what be prepared because it's probably the most. I would rank it among my top five as far as most disturbing films I've ever seen.
Oh, well, then you need to watch Vincent Cassel and Monica Bellucci and
Irreversible.
But you know, in terms of weird, nothing tops Eraserhead.
Yeah, that's a classic one. But even like this movie, like Possession, I was like comparing it to Eraserhead, and well, this one has a bit more. You can easily follow along with it, but Possession, it's so disturbing. There's stuff in there that you're not going to forget just because how graphic and disturbing it is.
I have a really disturbing Italian movie up in my office. It's so weird that I have it hidden under other things so it can't get out.
What is it?
It's a movie called, I think it's called Salo, or it's by Salo.
127 Days of Sodom.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my God, what a very, very upsetting, disturbing. I can't even believe what the script must have looked like. How did they get this made?
Yeah. I just want to know who like came up with this idea. It's like, what were you thinking at the time? What were you going
through?
Well,
were going through the works of the Marquis de Sade and trying to make a story out of it. Yeah, I mean, just really, really sick stuff.
There's a funny video.
The Bill cook, the thief, the wife, and his lover. That's another one.
So there was this video Bill Hader, the Criterion, did on YouTube, and they always have these things where some people come in, they go to the closet full of Criterion movies and they pick out a few, and then Bill Hader picks out 127 Days. He's like, you know, this is a really good date movie. Bring your girlfriend to. And he goes, I especially love this scene where, and then he gets bleeps everything out, and then bleeps, and he goes, and there's another great scene where this one woman bleep, and it just keeps going. It's hilarious.
Also Caligula.
God.
Which, believe it or not, has a really young Helen Mirren in it.
Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
Peter O'Toole.
Yes.
Gielgud. I mean, I don't think any of them realized they were on for what's basically an artsy porno.
Oh, what a weird movie, though. I mean, it's some of the things that are the most sick about it aren't even sexual. You know, it's the burying people up to their heads in sand and then having the knife thing go slicing across the... Oh, my God. Weird ideas.
Disgusting stuff. And, like, I remember one of the producers of the film was Bob Guccione, who was a Hustler. I think he's Penthouse, Larry Flint's Hustler. No, I know my pornographic history.
Sorry, I'm not up to date.
But he ran a Hustler Penthouse, and like they show in like the movie all these really up close, like basically porn shots of these orgies where they're showing up close, and it's just God, like what? Like, especially Gielgud and Peter O'Toole, they're like, you know, I do Shakespeare and Lawrence of Arabia. What am I doing in this like artsy porno?
Well, you know, I don't know how they got him to do that.
I don't know.
But the orgies in there are, I don't know, more disturbing than the one in Perfume. Mm-hmm. One in Perfume's almost sanitized because you don't see anything.
It doesn't even look like they're just more like touching each other and like feeling each other more than like any sexual act.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so getting close to my questions here. Anything else you want to bring up about aberrant movies or Perfume?
Well, I think this one is very weird, but I don't think it's the weirdest one in the box.
No, compared to something like Possession or the other films we talked about, it's pretty mild.
It's pretty mild.
But
it's
still pretty weird.
Starter weirdness.
Starter for if you want to get on.
This is a starter drug for weird movies.
Kickstarter pack for like you want to get into weird stuff. All right, then. So last question I'll have is tell us a little bit about your classes.
This semester, every semester, I teach Introduction to Film, Intro to American Cinema, and Intro to World Cinema. And when we talk about German film, I usually show Run, Lola, Run. And I will at least tell them about Perfume. But you're right. It's not a movie for everybody. Yeah.
Okay, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Tom Tykwer and his 2006 film, Perfume. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, because it's a legend, you numbskull.